It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at the future of the Milwaukee Bucks franchise after yesterday's proposed sale of the team.
But first, voting rights and election access have been in the news lately, with Wisconsin's voter ID laws hung up in the courts and talk of a special legislative session to tweak those rules after the courts rule. There are similar laws in court cases around the country, and in the last week, President Obama and other Democrats have made Election Day access a major talking point.
Our Central Time historian says arguments over voting rights and poll access have a long history here in the United States. Jonathan Pollack is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College, and he joins us each month to put a current news item in historical context.
John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Before we dig into the history, do we take voting as seriously now as we did historically, do you think?
Well, I think it's one of those things that goes through ebbs and flows. I mean, if you look at, say, voting in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, it was intense and serious to the point of being downright scary. Elections were often accompanied by torchlight campaigns. When we go back to like the 1840 election.
No, when you say torchlight campaigns, these are kind of menacing torchlight campaigns.
Yeah. So it's nighttime and it's the 1840s. There's no streetlights yet. So you've got people marching around with torches in the darkness. And I'm thinking in particular here of like the William Henry Harrison campaign in 1840, the Tippecanoe and Tyler II thing, which was in some ways the first modern political campaign. And so you've got people marching around by torchlight, and you've got their supporters loaded up on hard cider and rot-gut booze.
It's kind of like the Final Four.
Yeah, drunken torchlight parades. Yeah, kind of. Probably a few couches were burnt in the process. Davenports, they would have been called then, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So there are these torchlight parades that would go on, arguments between people of different political persuasions, between the Whigs and Democrats at that point, or Democrats and Republicans in the years to come.
So the whole concept of political divisiveness.
Yeah, so the divisiveness would be there, and people would follow it up with fists. We complain about the overheated rhetoric of the president, and where is the bipartisan sentiment, and so forth. But you know, people actually duking it out on the floor of the state legislature is less common than it used to be. So yeah, elections, I think, have gone through periods of time where, number one, there's intense activity, and there's really, when we look at the development even of political gangs in many cities, they began as auxiliaries of political parties or of different factions of a party designed to sort of turn out the vote and suppress physically people from turning out and voting. When we go back to that, we can say, well, yeah, people took it a lot more seriously, but there are also periods of great voter apathy, of times where, you know, we get maybe 60% of the population actually turns out to vote in a presidential election. So in some ways, you know, other historians, other pundits and observers have talked about in a lot of ways the U.S. is going back to the 1890s. And one of them, I think, is maybe with the seriousness of elections, that voting and so forth was so long kind of being worked up about voting was kind of the province of social studies teachers in high schools who would try to encourage
right.
people to vote. And now people are really kind of paying attention to it. It's becoming a much more alive issue.
So why do you think that's the case? I mean, historically, why was that the case?
Well, I think there are different reasons historically. When we're talking about going back to like 1840, for example. So 1840 elections are one where in most parts of the country, the only people who are voting are going to be white males. So you've got a reduced electorate, but you've got a sense that the stakes are really high. There was a lot of social activity wrapped up in voting, that you had social clubs that were tied to one party or another, or a faction of a party in a big city. And so voting was part of your gang, part of your people that you hung out with on a regular basis. Later on, let me talk about voting after the Civil War, when slavery was gone, when blacks had been emancipated and were able to vote. Then you get the same kind of conflict reoccurs in southern states, where white vigilante mobs tried to ensure that even though blacks had the right to vote, they would not go and exercise it.
Hmm.
So there are, it's a recurring kind of intensity, a recurring kind of like mob activity. And in the present, I think in many cases there's a phrase, you know, you don't miss what you have until it's gone. You don't miss your water until the well runs dry and so forth. And voting, I think, is one of the things that people took for granted for a long time, that the trend Really, up until about 10 years ago, the trend was to make voting easier and easier. States like Oregon began, voting online. More states adopted Wisconsin's model of same-day registration and voting to simplify that process. States expanded the possible hours that you could vote in person early. More people applied for absentee ballots, and the process of getting an absentee ballot was easier. And then within the last 10 years, that's been kind of rolled back. And when people are accustomed to something that's really easy, you know, and it's kind of taken away from them, they sit up and they pay attention a little bit and they say, wait, what's going on here? And they get kind of agitated.
So we'd like you to join the conversation too. If you're riled up about voting or thinking about it a lot more these days, like a lot of people are, you can join the conversation, and we can also put a historical spin on it as well with our guest. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. What do you think is a key issue related to election laws these days? Do you have concerns about that? Would you like some historical perspective on it? Any questions about election history in the U.S. are open right now. The number is 800-642-1234. And you kind of alluded to this at one point, but you've said that at one point white males were the only people who could vote. There also was a situation where you had to own land to do that, right?
Yeah, that was earlier. By the time of the Civil War, states had gotten rid of the land ownership requirement. So that was an expansion of voting. Certainly by the 1828 election that brought Andrew Jackson in, a lot of the people who voted for Andrew Jackson were not big landholders, mm-hmm. as would have been the case before. But coupled with the liberalization of voting and the expansion of voting, beginning in the 1860s and 1870s, southern state governments began enacting piecemeal changes to the voting process, additional requirements that made it harder for many people to vote, in particular, made it harder for African Americans to vote. So it's also, the experience of the period from like 1865, 1870 on through about 1900 is an important idea that I stress in the classes I teach in history quite a bit, is we often see this kind of lowercase p progressive vision of history where people get more rights over time, and that's pretty much a one-way slope. But actually, it's kind of a back and forth.
It's like a wave.
It's a wave, right. Exactly, that there are times where rights are expanded and then rights get taken away and people have to fight to expand the rights, and it goes back and forth. So the restrictions undertaken in the late 19th century, what's fascinating about them is that due to the constitutional amendments passed after the Civil War, as a way of getting around those and trying to reestablish facts on the ground as they existed before the Civil War, where only whites could vote, the laws in some ways sound – they're in line with other practices in the United States. They seem innocuous, but when taken together – and with the additional factor of just outright intimidation that could exist,
right.
They had a very strong effect on restricting the number of blacks who could vote. That, for example, in Louisiana from 1890 to 1900, the number of black voters simply evaporates. By 1890, something like 5% of blacks in the state of Louisiana are able to vote.
It's not because they're gone. It's because of these
rules.
Right.
It's because there were still the same number of people there and more people there. But no, their ability to vote was hampered by poll taxes, by charging people a tax to vote, creating what were called by creating literacy tests were a huge part of it. I mean, both of these on their face, we often charge people for things that they don't do. We don't require people to vote in the United States. We don't require people to hunt. So sure, if you want to hunt, take out a hunting license and take out as many as you want, depending on what you hunt. And so by that political theory, it makes sense. Oh, we don't have to vote. If you want to vote, if you're like me and you vote all the darn time, great. Go and take out a permit for that. And if not, save yourself a few bucks. In practice, what that because the widespread nature of black poverty in the late 19th century, many people didn't have the extra few bucks to vote. That was a huge burden to come up with a few dollars to pay for the poll tax. Additionally, I hear literacy tests. People talk about this all the time. An election comes up they don't like, and people say, stupid people are voting. That's the problem here. We should have some kind of test
right.
where people have to know. They have to be like Wisconsin public radio listeners. They have to be up on things. They have to know what's what in order to vote. Why can't we just do that? Well, we tried that in the 19th century, and the problem was that the states never defined what literacy was, and the counties never defined it. They said, oh, we've got a county clerk who can determine those things. He or she will know. They'll be able to test if someone's literate or not. So in case after case, when white voters came in to register, especially if the person as the clerk knew them, they just said, oh, well, you graduated high school ahead of me. I know you know how to read and write. We're not going to test you. When black voters came in, they faced much steeper examples of literacy tests.
So we're talking about elections with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison College, about the history of voting rights and voting access in the United States. We do have a number of calls that we'll go to in just a minute, and you can join the conversation as well.
What do you make of the current debate over voter ID, and what Election Day issues are on your mind? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org.
We'll go to the phones in just a minute, but first, a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
President Barack Obama says the U.S. and its allies are waiting to see if Russia follows through on an agreement reached today in Geneva about the crisis in Ukraine. Speaking at the White House, Obama says he hopes Russia will honor its promises about intervention in the former Soviet state. If not, he says Moscow will face additional sanctions. A new government report says the Internal Revenue Service audits less than 1% of large partnerships. That's according to the Government Accountability Office. It says the number of large businesses organized as partnerships has more than tripled since 2002, yet hardly any get close to scrutiny by the IRS. Governor Scott Walker has declared another propane emergency. Midwestern states have been grappling with a propane shortage spurred by the cold weather, a temporary pipeline closure, and heavy propane demand for drying grain last fall. Walker's new executive order lifts weight limits and hour restrictions through April 26th. For Central Time, I'm Kristen Durst.
One of our listeners tells us that her tomato sauce tastes better when she makes it while listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. If WPR makes your life better in too many ways to count, make a special gift by becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle with a gift of $100 a month or more. Call 800-383-9772 or visit us online at WPR.org. And thank you.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Steep & Brew, a Wisconsin coffee roaster dedicated to delivering truly fresh, premium coffee to your grocer. Coffee roasted today is delivered within 72 hours. Steep & Brew, coffee done right. Online at steepandbrew.com.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We continue our conversation with Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison College and Central Time's resident historian. We're talking about the history of voting rights and Election Day access in the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@WPR.org. What do you think was a key moment or change in the nation's election laws? Do you have questions about it? You can call in and join that conversation at 800-642-1234. In fact, we're going to dive right into the calls right now with Scott from Wisconsin Rapids. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you. Great topic. So I'm wondering, you know, we were listening to the guest talk about how all these poll taxes and these obstacles that were put in front of people back in the 19th century, here we are, the 21st century, doing the same thing again, albeit not as dramatic, but we're itching our way closer and closer. We got one side of the political aisle saying there's all kinds of corruption or voter ID that we need voter ID for, but clearly there's not corruption going on. And yet, why don't they just call it what it is and say they're trying to limit people from voting for a certain party? And, you know, maybe I might respect them more. But this whole issue, it seems we're creeping right back to where we were. And I guess that apparently is fine for some of the electorate, and I don't understand that.
Well, Scott, thanks for that call. Jonathan Pollack, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the differences, and I hope in the calls that come through, we have a chance to go through similarities and differences and continuity and change. I think one of the differences is that I think the caller was onto something, that the efforts to restrict the vote were much more overt back in the late 19th century. For example, in 1884, after a coalition of white Republicans who had come south and African-Americans had gotten a majority in the Virginia state legislature, in the 1884 elections, white vigilante groups took out full-page ads in newspapers warning black voters that if they attempted to vote, they'd be shot. So this is like there's no mistaking this.
It's pretty,
pretty
overt.
Completely overt. And voter ID, I mean, here in Wisconsin, it's this kind of strange mixture of things. Because on the one hand, where governors often, when there's a piece of legislation they're especially eager to have passed, and it's a big live issue that's been resolved, they'll have a big signing ceremony, they'll invite people, they'll distribute official pens and so forth. And our governor is very quiet about signing the voter ID laws that the legislature just passed. But at the same time, given all the possible issues that confront our state this year, Governor Walker has said that as the court cases wind their way through, if they in some way find that the voter ID laws enacted are not okay, that he wants to call the legislature back in a special session to resolve voter ID, indicating this is hugely important. So it's really it's really hard to call this one. You know, does that count as like an overt signaling about voter ID?
But is this something that you would have seen as recently as 10 years ago, though? I mean,
well, 10 years ago, 10 years ago is when the voter ID campaign kind of began. Alberto Gonzalez and the Bush administration kind of called on attorneys general around the United States to find voter fraud and root it out. And there was a great deal of money spent on this. Attorneys general or people working for the U.S. Attorney General's office who didn't find voter fraud were kind of called on the carpet and asked why they weren't looking hard enough and accused of covering up. But nothing really turned up. I mean, there were a handful of cases here and there generally involving people who cast an absentee ballot and then voted, or people who owned multiple properties and voted at their summer home address and their winter home address. But yeah, all along the campaign for voter ID, one of the differences is it's been much more quiet for the most part, and it's only very recently that even the Democrats, the party who seems most affected by these laws if they come to pass, the Democrats from President Obama on down have been really vocal about it.
We're talking about voting rights today, putting it in historical perspective. Do you have a question for us? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to Jamie. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. I was wondering, would the guest be willing to answer what suggestions he feels might work well to add to the U.S. Constitution as an amendment to actually instill voting rights something that's not a privilege, something that should be guaranteed, and also whether or not that's even passable.
All right, Jamie, thanks for that. Quite a load of questions there for you. I do think, you know, the election laws kind of vary from state to state, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So the way that we administer that so much of the responsibility for administering elections falls to the states, I think would make any constitutional amendment kind of difficult to put in there. I do know there's a group that's been circulating, or a few members of Congress have been circulating like a draft of a right to vote amendment to the Constitution. And I don't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it's relatively short and concise. And it says that states shall not enact anything that impinges on the right to vote or something like that. So on the one hand, it seems like that would do the job. On the other hand, I can envision that, you know, the word impinges or whatever restricts, whatever term that is, that would be, you know, the subject of much debate and efforts to interpret that narrowly or interpret it broadly. The right to vote. So, you know, we currently exclude various classes of people from voting, people under the age of 18, people in prison in most states, in many states, people who've committed felonies even after they've served the term. So does that negate those laws? Does it, you know, what happens to that? I mean, if I were more of a constitutional scholar, and if that were more my area, more the present, I'd have a better idea on how you could write a more foolproof amendment. But at this, you know, given my knowledge base, that's the best I can do. is to point up the you know, what's out there and the difficulties those things face.
Well, Jamie, thanks for that question. And one question comes to mind, though, is looking over the history of voting. It sounds like a lot of it driven by passionate political views, driven by issues related to people from different races and stuff. But what about technology? I mean, are there other examples in history where technology raised questions about voting? Like, for example, the absentee ballot stuff and, you know, things of that
sort. Yeah, so, to be honest, I don't – I can't call up the history of absentee ballots right now.
Right.
But what I can think of, what sort of a technology that came up is the first of all, the rise of the secret ballot, which was an Australian import in the late 19th century. That one of the other
so it's Australian.
The Australian ballot was the original name of the secret ballot. So one of the things also to consider about voting then before, and I think that kind of came in like the 1870s, 1880s. So before that, voting was super public. You know, you've got two boxes. You know, if you've got two candidates running for an election, you've got two boxes. And you drop your card in the box, and it's a matter of public record. Anybody who's hanging around the courthouse or the whatever the polling place is that day knows exactly who put their card in which box.
And so was the secret ballot adopted because that kept some people from voting?
Or? Yeah, because it led to all kinds of coercion in the process. You know, you've got most people who vote have some sense of the political climate in their area, and if they went for the Democratic candidate in a Republican area or vice versa. And you've got people who are known to be members of the majority party kind of sitting there like, drumming a billy club on their hand while you're voting. This is seriously intimidating
the
voter.
That would be a bit of a buzzkill.
So the secret ballot kind of undermined that whole process. But then that opened up the question, well, are people stuffing the ballot boxes? How do we know, if it's a secret, how do we know who actually voted? So in a sense, that's like a very small T kind of technology that came in that had questions about its adaptation.
Let's go to one more call. Dennis, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. I'm just calling in. When we talk about the voter ID debate, it's often talk about whether or not there's fraud going on. And I think the bigger issue for me anyways is, the voter turnout on off years is relatively low. And the feeling I get when I go there is, boy, wouldn't it be easy for anyone to say they're me? And, their chances of getting away with that is pretty good, especially in these off-year elections.
All right, Dennis, thanks for that question.
Well, I mean, that's certainly been the rationale for voter ID. And the thing I find kind of problematic about that idea is that, what's the payoff? What's the payoff and what's the risk? The risks for voter impersonation are pretty big. I mean, the cases of voter fraud that we've seen, the person who was registered at one address and voted at a different one and took a photo of her ballot and put it on Facebook and such, that's a pretty serious violation there. And it's for what? I mean, people will take chances to get a large amount of money for short-term use, but voting's pretty abstract. So We haven't found evidence of that going on in large numbers. That's why I have a hard time believing that it actually does or that people would want to do it.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for a lively discussion about a topic. We really appreciate it.
Thank you once again.
All right. Thanks a lot. Jonathan Pollack is a history instructor at Madison College. It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn more about a famous Madison playwright in our Wisconsin Legends segment.
But first, the news broke yesterday that former Wisconsin senator and Milwaukee Bucks owner Herb Cole is selling the Milwaukee Bucks for a cool $550 million.
The new owners are two New York-based hedge fund investors who, along with Cole, say they're committed to keeping the team in Milwaukee. They've pledged funds toward a new arena, but there are still significant hurdles to getting one built. That's got people asking questions about the future of professional basketball in the city.
Joining us now to talk more about the sale and the future of the team in Milwaukee is Don Walker. He's a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Business of Sports blog. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we knew this day was coming. Cole had suggested in the past that he was seeking additional investors for the team, but I think some people were surprised that he actually gave up complete ownership. What do we know about the new owners?
Well, we're still learning quite a bit about the new owners, but one thing we can say with real certainty is they have an awful lot of money in their wallets. They have agreed to pay $550 million, as you reported, and pledged at least $100 million toward construction of a new arena. Folks that I've spoken with in the sports industry business say that is highly unusual for a prospective owner or owners to make that kind of a commitment. The $550 million, I should point out, is an eye-popping number, if for no other reason that the Milwaukee Bucks are generally considered to be the least valued team in the NBA. Forbes magazine, as recently as January, valued them at $405 million. So former Senator Cole certainly got a premium on his investment.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet deal. Now the question, though, is, I mean, that's a huge difference, though. It's valued at $405 million in January. It sells for $555 million. Plus, they're throwing in another $100 million for the idea of a new venue. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think what's happening here, first of all, is you have to keep in mind, and this is based on conversations I've had with sports industry people. For those who are wealthy investors, there's a lot of money out there in the marketplace, so there's money to be spent. Secondly, assuming you're a basketball fan, an NBA franchise is a precious asset. There are only 30 of them around. Consequently, there is going to be demand for them among people who have the financial wherewithal to pay for one. And in this case, the bidding, there was approximately 9 very serious bidder groups for this team. And the company that was handling the sale for Senator Cole, Allen & Company, based in New York, said simply the bidding went up, but this particular group went in with a very high bid, stuck to it, did their homework, and convinced the senator that they were the right team pair to take over the team.
Now, is this kind of like if you buy an old classic car that's in really bad shape, but you can fix it up and it's worth more money? Is that the deal with this whole thing?
Well, I think there is some of that, but also my sense is that the other attraction for these gentlemen was the opportunity to build a new arena, again, assuming there's public support for that, and that, of course, is not a given. But I think it was attractive to them to have the potential to build an arena to their liking with, you know, all the bells and whistles that newer arenas have.
And then those bells and whistles can make a lot of money, too, right? Is that part of it as well?
Well, absolutely. You know, just this afternoon I was at the BMO Harris Bradley Center, the current home of the Milwaukee Bucks, and was reminded again of some of the shortcomings in the arena. As an example, there are only 7,000 lower bowl seats in the Bradley Center. Most NBA arenas have upwards of 10,000 or more lower bowl seats. These, of course, are seats that are considered the best viewing for a basketball game. So there are things like that. There are issues about the suites at the current Bradley Center, and I'm thinking that the new owners feel that they can build a better mousetrap and attract more people and generate more revenue for the Bucks.
Now, the new owners have pledged to keep the team in Milwaukee. That seems to be an important thing to Herb Cole, I think, in making the deal, right? So do you think that's going to happen, though? Because, I mean, some people say, remember the Seattle Supersonics.
Well, I agree. Nothing is certain in life, and I do. I'm not prepared to say that they have made this lifelong commitment to keep the team in Milwaukee. And I'll give you an example. If there is significant public opposition to providing some measure of public support to complete the financing for a new arena, there could very well be a scenario in which these two owners walk away. Do I think that might happen? I don't know. That's going to get played out over the next few years. But both the senator and the two gentlemen buying the team have indicated that there will have to be some form of additional public support, whether that's in the form of sales taxes or what have you, I don't know.
Now, Herb Cole has said he's going to put $100 million in. The new owners have said they're going to put $100 million in, but it's a $400 million project. Do you think the fact that they're willing to put so much skin in the game could make it easier to convince people in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin that this is something to support?
No question about it. That announcement yesterday, as far as I was concerned, was almost as important as the announcement of the sale of the team. It very much gives the arena construction debate a jump start. $400 million has been bandied about as a price tag for a new arena, but those kinds of things do tend to get higher over time. So $400 million may be a floor for a cost of a new arena. Could very well approach $450 million or more. It all depends on the design, and we won't know that for a very long time.
Have you done any research on the situation with other teams and other cities where they've had a condition where they wanted a new facility and wound up walking or anything like that?
Not necessarily. I mean, in most cases, professional sports franchises, with the support of their commissioner as well as key elected officials, generally speaking, across the country, have been able to convince the public of the need to fund these arenas. And I should point out, in the interest of fairness and balance, that there are very few sports economists who would agree on, they would disagree on a lot of things, but one thing they generally agree on is that these new stadiums, arenas, are not necessarily economic generators. And so that debate we will hear more and more in the coming months.
So if the arena winds up not being built, if, as people debate it, they determine that's not the thing to do you think it's fair to say that the team is as good as gone?
Well, Senator Cole said it himself. He says the money will be gone. I would read into that not only would his own money be gone, but these owners could very well walk away. Now, we don't know the circumstances of the sale agreement, but it seemed pretty clear to me in listening to Senator Cole yesterday is that if there is no arena, that makes this sale problematic at best.
Now, the sale isn't final until the NBA approves it. Is there any reason to think that it would be denied?
They're meeting as we speak right now. There is not a vote expected this week on approving the sale. It'll likely come in the next few months, probably via telephone conference call. I don't see anything at this juncture that would stand in the way of a successful sale.
Well, Don, thanks so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Don Walker is a reporter and blogger at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. American playwright and novelist Thornton Wilder won 3 Pulitzer Prizes for the novel The Bridge at San Luis Rey and for the plays Our Town and The Skin of Our Teeth. Plus, he won the U.S. National Book Award for the novel The Eighth Day.
Wilder was born in Madison on April 17, 1897, 117 years ago today. His nephew, Tappan Wilder, joins us from California to celebrate his life and his work. Tappan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Cynthia. Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for making the time. What brought Wilder's family to Madison?
Well, their father, Amos, was looking to buy a newspaper, and he got at least partial ownership of the Wisconsin State Journal in 1894, bought a share, and brought a new wife out there, and they family lived there. There were 4 kids born pretty quickly. And they lived until 1906 when he went on to China. He fell afoul, in part, of La Follette, and that was not a good enemy to make in the state of Wisconsin in 1906.
That's funny.
So they moved to Hong Kong.
And how long did he stay here?
Well, that was the 1894 to 1906. There you are.
Okay.
That was it.
And tell us a little bit about your uncle's first writings. What were they like?
Well, there's a lot of romance in them. The Bridge of San Luis Rey, the Cabala, the Woman of Andros. Those are the novels that brought him really to great fame as a writer. You can go way back before that because by the age of 15, he was already writing 3-minute plays for 3 people and some longer plays that we know of. He was writing all the time, but they were often romantic. There were lots of knights and all the other things that people throw into things. What was fascinating was his early fascination in form. And he was also as a student, you know, he'd read Ibsen, he'd write a little play that would involve Ibsen. He'd meet some neighbors, perhaps, and he'd write a play about that. But it was all but very interested in form. There was a huge amount of discipline in his life already as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was very dramatic. I mean, the deepest instincts, I think, were very dramatic.
Right. Well, he won his first...
That's a big question you've asked. I could talk an hour and a half about that, but I know we'll move on.
I appreciate your effort here. Well, he won his first Pulitzer Prize at the age of 30 for The Bridge of San Luis Rey, as you mentioned.
Right.
But what made that novel such a success and so early in his career?
Well, some people are still asking that question, because here was a novel that was the publishers expected to sell. They published a little over 3,000 copies, which is a few more than the first one he published. But they thought it was for a very sophisticated audience, and right off the bat, at the end of the first year, it sold over 300,000 copies, if you count England in the American totals. It was a huge, huge story. Well, it's a great story. It's got everything. People die in a bridge, marvelous characters, set in 18th century Peru. It had an extraordinary style. It stood against the Dreiser tradition, and some people were tired of that. This is long ago now. But we read it, I think, for what we find in it ourselves. And I get letters, as he did, from people who are emotionally deeply moved by that novel today. And when there's a terrible tragedy, its last lines are often read, commonly read. Mm. And thousands of copies of this book are still sold. So it's really about us. So it's like our town, except it's a fictional version. And we see ourselves in it. And it asks questions that are so common to all our lives. The Russell Banks, who wrote the marvelous introduction to it, calls it the most perfect moral fable in American literature. Mm. Well, there you are. You go read it and tell me what you...
We'll have another show on that. Yeah. Well, Wilder was part of this generation of great writers, F. Scott Fitzgerald and John O'Hara, and they all went on to write for Hollywood as well. Did Wilder go on to do so?
Oh, sure. You know, listen, that's where the money was in the 1930s. And he certainly did well with The Bridge of San Luis Rey, but there was this thing called the Great Depression, and he was supporting family and all sorts of people, including himself. Yeah, he turned up there for the first time in 1934. He had an agent in Hollywood who got him a big deal, and he wrote a treatment for Goldwyn, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer of the day, for a Joan of Arc treatment for a movie never made. And he helped out in a few others. Had a marvelous time. Was the key at every party. Marvelous. Went, roller skating with Disney, a marvelous time. And then he left. He used to say, spend more than 8 or 10 weeks in Hollywood and you lose your soul. He took the check, that was what he needed, and he left.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really come back until early 40s, when he was asked by Hitchcock to come out, and he wrote a very famous movie called Shadow of a Doubt. And he helped with Our Town movie made in the same period. But he never went back in any regular way, although people offered him jobs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't depend on it. When it was there, he needed it. It was there if he wanted it, and when he'd pick up a little work when he wanted it.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about your relationship with him. How often did you see him? Tell us a little bit about maybe a side of him that most people don't know.
Well, I was born in 1940. And Thornton Wilder lived his base for many years was Hamden, Connecticut, just outside New Haven. And I would see him, and I went to college in New Haven. So after about 1958, till really I left there in 1979 with a few years, I was pretty much there at the university, both as a student and later as an employee. I would see him when he came there. Wilder, my uncle, was would arrive. I get a phone call, and I'd be whisked off to a wonderful dinner. This is a man who knew everybody. He wasn't like, he wasn't like Hemingway, his friend Hemingway, who could drink anybody under the table and also knock them down. And he wasn't in the front pages for his behavior, like his great friend Scott Fitzgerald, who had trouble, all kinds of troubles, and he and his wife were big news. But he was a very convivial man. He loved people. He loved to meet people. And he was awful good to his nephew. He was very interested when he met you. He'd ask you 20 questions right off the bat about what you were talking about, and you'd want to talk to him about it. He didn't want to talk about himself. He wanted to hear what really was important in your life. And I think as human a person as I've ever known, but also very private. He was a very private person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was the eyes on the wall, always you know, he spent over 200 days a year writing in other places than home. His base was Hampton, Connecticut, and he had a study there. But much of his work was done in Europe, was done on boats. Once he would offer 20 months to Douglas, Arizona, in the early 60s, where he began to write what some people think of his greatest novel. You've mentioned it, The Eighth Day, which won the National Book Award. Now, what was Douglas, Arizona? It was, in those days, one of the great copper smelting sites of the world. You know, can imagine the sky dark with smoke. He never mentions any kind of pollution. He just wanted to get away from what he called a coterie. And he used to tell his nephew all the time, listen to the multitude, don't get caught up in the coterie. That was the Midwesterner in him, by the way.
Something to keep in mind for all of us, I think. So yeah. Many of his novels, so much of his work was romantic in nature. Would you say that he's a romantic himself?
No. No, that's the wrong term. I described that when I described his early work. He's pretty hard-headed. You know, our town is a very, very tough place. And yeah. So is the Bridge of St. Louis Ray, by the way. You know, this the great novel. These are very, very tough. They ask, as Thornton used to say, it was the job of the writer to try and pose the question right. And we sometimes, because of their particular association for many years with the high schools, have tended critics would look at this and people would look back on it from their experiences maybe as some kind of a romantic. I use the phrase, they think our town is a kind of a chocolate milkshake. Well, it's not a chocolate milkshake. It's a very tough play. And so I wouldn't use that term. I think he's a very complex, interesting writer. And the fact that all his works are in print today, all his novels, all his major plays, even his short one-act plays, which do so well, says that he speaks to our time. And it's a kind of golden age for my uncle right now, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. I was taking a look at Penelope Niven's biography of Thornton Wilder.
You bet.
Yeah. You spoke at his funeral in 1975, and you read a passage of his own work. Can you share a little bit about what you chose and why you chose it?
Well, it wasn't my choice only. I worked that out with my Aunt Isabel, his sister. There were four Wilder kids born in Madison, and they proved to be all writers, by the way. They're all being rediscovered, Isabel among them. My father's works are going back in print, and Charlotte's poems are being republished. It's kind of an interesting time for the Wilder family. But they're going back to the service. Isabel, I wanted some of them, and I did have a chance to add one or two things that I liked from the. But, you know, that's so long ago. You know, I'm not a kid anymore. I can't remember exactly.
No worries.
It was a negotiation. Let's
put
it that way.
Well, Tappan Wilder, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tappan Wilder. He's the nephew of playwright and novelist Thornton Wilder, who was born in Madison, Wisconsin, on this day in 1897.